Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the U.S. dollar become the world's most coveted currency, and are its days of singular dominance likely to end soon? Far beyond national pride, the dollar's primacy carries substantial benefits for the U.S. economy, even in these troubled and uncertain times. As my guest today will explain, currencies from China and the EU in particular could in the future rival the dollar as choices for global business, but that shift is unlikely to be rapid or devastating. Barry Eichengreen is professor of political science and economics at UC Berkeley and author of the new book Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. Barry, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So, conventional wisdom has it that the dollar rose to global currency after the Second World War. You remind us here, though, that it was rivaling the pound sterling by the 1920s, just a few years after the creation of the U.S. Federal Reserve.
That's right. And indeed, one of the reasons that the Fed was created was that banks and exporters in the United States didn't like having to go to London for credit when they imported and exported merchandise and when they sought to invest abroad. So the Federal Reserve Act allowed U.S. banks to branch abroad for the first time. The Fed created international market and trade credits. It took only 10 years from 1914 until 1924 for the dollar to become a true global currency rivaling the pound sterling. So the point I take from that is that we shouldn't take the dollar's global dominance for granted today. Other currencies could come along in as few as 10 years.
And a couple of things have to exist in order for any currency to achieve international status. Talk about those.
The two things you need are liquid markets in your currency, and we certainly have that in the United States, and the expectation of stability, that the currency will hold its value, that the government will stand behind its debt obligations, and there, clearly, we have a problem in the medium term. People worry about the debt. They worry about whether U.S. fiscal policy is on a sustainable path. I don't think there's going to be flight away from the dollar anytime soon, partly because there aren't a lot of attractive alternatives at the moment, but there will be.
How did the pound sterling's fall from prominence affect the British economy?
The British economy was overtaken by the United States as in terms of output already in the 1870s, as an exporter already during World War I, and then the UK had mounting economic problems, economic and financial problems, partly as a result of high unemployment, partly through an inability to grow. I think, again, there is a lesson there for the U.S. If we succeed in growing our economy, we will be able to maintain the dollar's position as the leading international currency. But conversely, if we fail to successfully address the growth problem, alternatives will come along.
Yeah, let's talk about that growth issue, because at the end of the Second World War, the U.S. economy was something like 40% of the global GDP, which is pretty extraordinary. Now, as we see other economies growing faster than ours, particularly those in Asia and in particular China, do we need to worry if China does, in fact, as predicted, eclipse the size of the U.S. economy?
Well, we need to worry in the following sense, that the United States has been the source of safe, liquid assets that the world economy runs on. Importers and exporters, global banks, foreign governments all need liquidity. They all need safe assets in which to do business. And we, the United States, have been providing them now for half a century. The problem is that now that the U.S. is only 20% of the global economy, we don't have the capacity to provide those safe and liquid assets on our own. Someone has to come along and supplement our ability to do that. And that someone, I think, will be China 10 years from now? Do we have to worry about China? Therefore, the argument I make in my book is no, we should really welcome China's emergence on the global stage because the U.S. economy is no longer big enough to manage the global financial system and provide the liquidity it needs all by itself.
Barry, explain this for us. What is the benefit to foreign traders and foreign economies in doing their business in dollars, even when both sides of a transaction bypass the United States?
The dollar is the standard store of value. The dollar is the standard unit of measurement. It's easy to compare prices of exporters of different countries if they're all denominated in dollars. So the dollar is the standard measuring rod of the global economy. It has been for half a century. And because it's the standard, it has an advantage. People are used to doing business in dollars. They're used to comparing prices in dollars. So the dollar has what economists refer to as the first mover advantage. But the argument I make in my book is that that advantage can be lost rather quickly in the event of economic mismanagement and if alternatives come along.
So let's talk about your title, Exorbitant Privilege, because the benefits to foreign interests using dollars exist as well for the United States, but there are some additional benefits that we derive as well, some exorbitant privilege. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I should mention that the phrase comes from French President Charles de Gaulle and his finance minister back in the 1960s, who were not at all happy about the fact that the United States could scoop up foreign companies on the cheap because we could pay for them using dollars that foreign governments and central banks both wanted. In addition, the dollar has the exorbitant privilege of being the world's safe haven. So when financial problems develop, when there's a financial crisis, everybody rushes into dollars because the market in dollars, the market in U.S. Treasury bonds in particular, is the most liquid, the deepest, the largest, single largest financial market in the world. So the irony here is that even when we create the financial problem ourselves, even when we have a subprime crisis in the U.S. that eventually infects the rest of the world, people rush into dollars and into the United States rather than out of it.
How much control do we have over things like interest rates based on the dollar's global currency standards?
Well, the Fed certainly is the single most important player on the global financial scene. So when the subprime crisis broke in 2007, it pretty quickly infected European banks as well. Banks like the big French bank, BNP, had borrowed dollars in order to buy subprime securities and the like. That made the Fed the most important player, and what we discovered eventually that the Fed had made a lot of dollar loans to French and German banks in order to keep the global financial system afloat. The Fed does have much more leverage than the typical national central bank by virtue of the fact that the dollar is not only our currency, but the world's.
Would the EU be better with something like the Fed? I mean, there are obviously complicating factors there because you have multiple companies contributing to this one currency standard.
The euro was created partly because the French and the Germans didn't like the dollar's exorbitant privilege, and they wanted to create a European currency on the continental scale necessary for it to play a global role. So the idea was that eventually the euro would rival the dollar, and eventually the European Central Bank would play a role equivalent globally to that played by the Fed. Things haven't quite played out as planned. The euro had been acquiring international business. It had been acquiring global market share in financial markets and as a currency for finance and trade over time, but it's been giving back that ground, obviously, as the European crisis has deepened.
If global commodities are priced typically in dollars, does that somehow make them more affordable for U.S. buyers when we're importing goods?
I don't think it really makes a difference. So if the dollar depreciates on the foreign exchange market, OPEC simply raises the dollar price of oil. So it's a convenience for U.S. banks and firms. It makes it easier for us when we read the newspaper to understand what's happening to global commodity or energy prices. But I don't think the currency of denomination really makes a difference.
Okay, and let's talk about productivity, because the U.S. economy has reported higher productivity than the EU, than Japan. What impact does that have on the primacy of the dollar?
Well, as I said before, I think our ability to grow our economy, our ability to grow the platform for the dollar, if you will be one of the most important determinants of whether or not it retains its global role in the future. So productivity growth is a good thing from that point of view, and the numbers that were released last week that indicated that productivity growth was a little better than expected are a positive. But it remains the case that the U.S. economy is only growing at 2% at the moment. That's only half the rate you would expect during a recovery. That's too slow to bring down the unemployment rate. So while the productivity numbers were a small silver lining, the clouds are still pretty dark.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Chinese economy, while it has slowed somewhat, is growing at, what, 7%, 8% at this point?
Yeah, 7%, 8% is a good guess. But we don't know the reality. The Chinese can publish any numbers they want, but 7% is probably the right ballpark.
So it turns out to be a major issue for China as the source of global currency. The Chinese currency is not readily convertible. Explain to us what that means and why it would be an impediment.
It means that foreigners cannot get their hands on Chinese currency or Chinese bonds except by selling goods to China. So the currency is convertible or obtainable for trade-related transactions, but not for financial transactions. So if you want to get Chinese renminbi-denominated bank deposits in Hong Kong, the only way you can make a deposit is by exporting merchandise to China. The very limited ability of foreigners to get their hands on the currency means that it's not particularly liquid. It's not valuable as an insurance policy against financial shocks, so it can't really play a global role yet. But having said that, Chinese officials have a blueprint. They have a plan for transforming the renminbi into a true first-class global currency within 10 years, and I wouldn't underestimate their ability to do so.
Barry Eichengreen is my guest. He's professor of political science and economics at UC Berkeley and author of the book Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. That book is out now in a paperback edition. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Political Science and Economics at UC Berkeley, Barry Eichengreen. His book, now out in a paperback edition, is called Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think at kera.org or by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. Barry, talk about the fact that the Chinese currency is not easily convertible unless there is a direct trade deal with China. What does that do in terms of giving the Chinese government ready cash to invest sort of as it sees fit?
It's not important for giving them ready cash. What it's important for is giving them control over their economy, their exchange rate, and their financial markets. So the Chinese are worried about hot money flowing in or potentially flowing out of the economy, destabilizing their exchange rate, their ability to export, and their banking system. So this is a reminder that China still has a ways to go in terms of building deeper, more liquid, more stable financial markets and strengthening its banking system. It's going to have to do all those things before it can open its financial markets to the rest of the world and transform its currency into a rival to the dollar.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Terry on the line in Dallas. Hello, Terry.
Hello. Yes, I have a question. You know, back since the 80s, I'd heard about this global expansion and new international laws as such. Ever since that, I've seen more revolutions around the world, more upheavals. We're going to rely on China, who 70% of their people are just severely impoverished. And they never give you that account. And they are not honest. And they want to trade by their own ways. And there's really no strict laws to control that. And we see this all over the world. I'd like to ask a question. How can we rely on a nation like that or any nation that's bound to be near a revolution? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I think Terry has a point. China is going to have to become more transparent. It's going to have to invest in rule of law. It's going to have to convince foreign investors that Shanghai is a safe place to park their money before it can play a true international role in financial markets like other places. That's a reminder that China has a long way to go before the renminbi will be co-equal to the dollar. So my argument is not that the renminbi will overtake the dollar in 10 years. But I think it will be second in line or maybe third in line between the dollar and the euro on the global stage. The other thing I would point out is that the caller and I agree that it would be desirable for China to move in the direction of rule of law, democracy, openness, transparency, and this aspiration to turn its currency into a true global currency will hasten that process. I think Chinese leaders understand they're going to have to invest in rule of law to make this happen. They're going to move more quickly in that direction than otherwise as a result of their plan to internationalize the renminbi.
Does the ongoing financial crisis in the EU, Barry, put the euro on a longer timeline now than, say, a decade away for the renminbi?
It does. So in the new paperback edition of my book, I have an update about what's happened in the last year. And it's clear that the crisis in the eurozone has delayed international adoption of the euro. So countries like Poland have made pretty clear that they're going to wait and see how things play out, and international banks are more reluctant to do cross-border business in euros because they don't know what the future of Europe's currency will be. They're no longer confident that it will still be around in 5 or 10 years.
Of course, that's also a pretty dramatic incentive for the Eurozone to get its act together in terms of fiscal policy.
That's right. The famous French official Jean Monnet, who was the father of the European Union, for better or for worse, said Europe is forged in crises. Europe only moves forward in response to a crisis. Well, it certainly has one now.
So what about Japan? Any possibility that Japan would ever be in play as a contender for global currency status?
I don't think so. When I go to Japan and talk about these things, my friends there ask me, why haven't you mentioned the yen? And I pause and remember the yen. And I say, because it peaked as international currency back at the end of the 1980s, when it accounted for less than 10% of the reserves of central banks around the world. And it's been down ever since. The reason is two lost decades, no economic growth in Japan. So there's a lesson, there for the United States. Avoid that at all costs. And number two, because of Japan's demographics, that their population is aging, their labor force is now declining because of very low birth rates. Japan is obviously not a country of immigration from the point of view of economic growth and growing the platform for your currency. The fact that the United States is a country of immigration and has more favorable demographic prospects, those things are definitely a positive.
Some of those conditions also have to be of concern for the Eurozone, where there is immigration, but a lot of people are very torn up about it. And, of course, we know there are multiple countries within the Eurozone where populations are not replacing themselves at adequate rates. Is that something that's being discussed in the EU with regard to the value of the euro?
It's something that has been discussed for quite a while now. So you're quite right that Europe is more demographically challenged than the United States, and that even under the best of circumstances, the European economy is likely to grow about half as fast as the U.S., but no more because of the slower rate of growth of the labor force. They've been talking for a long time about full membership or associate membership in the European Union for Turkey. That would really change matters. Turkey is a big country in terms of population. It's a very young country in terms of demographics. It has a rapidly growing labor force, and its economy has been growing by 6, 7, 8% a year, not a whole lot slower than China's. There are issues having to do with Europe's attitude toward immigrants, its attitude toward Muslims, its attitude toward poor economies that would be the recipients of transfer payments. But in terms of solving this demographic problem, reaching an agreement with Turkey would make a big difference.
My guest this hour is Barry Eichengreen, professor of political science and economics at UC Berkeley and author of the book Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. If you want to make a comment or ask a question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Has the value of the dollar relative to national currencies elsewhere affected its use as an international tender?
The dollar has been trending downward against foreign currencies slowly for about 10 years now. That hasn't done anything to discourage its international use. If there was a dollar crisis and a dollar collapse, that would definitely change the picture. But so far, seeing the dollar decline by 2 or 3 or 4% per annum hasn't been enough to scare away our foreign customers.
Talk about the factors that could potentially cause a crash in the value of the dollar?
I talk about this a lot in the book. People have been worried about whether there could be a dispute between the U.S. and China over the South China Sea or Taiwan or something like that, and whether China would use its financial weapon by selling off all the dollars it holds as a way of facing down the United States in such a conflict. I think that's unlikely because China would be shooting itself in the foot. If it sold off some of its dollars, it would be reducing the value of the others that it continued to hold. What I conclude in the book is if there's a dollar crash, it can only occur because we in the U.S. bring it upon ourselves by not getting our act together in terms of economic growth, by not putting in place a credible medium-term fiscal plan.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Brittany in Denton. Hi, Brittany.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My father was in manufacturing in Detroit, and recently we had a discussion about China stating that they could manufacture for the entire world and had no problem doing so. And our conversation basically went to how does China plan and how is that possible for the United States to compete with a challenge that big?
That's big and complicated and certainly important question. And the answer is that we can compete with China in a number of product lines because our workers are more productive than Chinese workers. It's true that your typical Chinese worker on an assembly line only earns a fifth as much as an assembly line worker in Detroit or South Carolina or wherever. But it's also true that they're only a fifth as productive. They don't have the same education. They don't have the same capital or machinery to work with. And that's why I think it's critically important that we invest in people in order to maintain our competitiveness. So I'm talking my book a little bit. I'm a teacher, but I think it's the right argument.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have James calling from Dallas. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, my question to that guy who is very knowledgeable is I wanted to know what are the top two or three economies in Africa that the U.S. does business with?
I wish I was knowledgeable enough to tell you for sure, but I think the answer is two of them are Nigeria and South Africa by virtue of their size and by virtue of their natural resources, including in the Nigerian case, petroleum.
Is it realistic to imagine that at any point in the near future and the next few decades that we could see somewhere from the continent of Africa a major global currency, one that would, if not rivaling the dollar, at least be considered a pretty significant force?
South Africa is a big economy. It has reasonably well-developed financial markets and banks. I think it has a long way to go before its currency plays a consequential international role. But if you look 20 or 30 years out and you ask what are the big economies going to be, the answer is along with the U.S. and the Eurozone, India, China, and probably an African economy like South Africa. If they do better in terms of investing in people, they can grow. They have good bankers and regulators, so they have a leg up in terms of that aspect.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Pakash on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Pakash.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you can comment about the price of the gold, the U.S. currency, and the Indian rupee. Thank you. I'll take your answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
The question, if I heard it correctly, was to comment on the price of gold.
The price of gold, the dollar, and the rupee.
Well, I'm tempted to respond forecasting those things or even commenting on them as above my pay grade. If I could predict what would happen to the price of gold or the dollar or the rupee, I would be a wealthy investor rather than an academic. I think that the dollar remains the least dirty shirt in the pile. That's the phrase that Bill Gross, the California bond manager, used. Europe's problems are greater than ours. At the moment, the problems of a number of emerging markets, including India, are greater than ours. So the dollar has been stable, and there's reason to think that it could strengthen over time. So I repeat, this is commentary rather than investment advice. India has kind of missed a critical window of time when it had high single-digit growth, when it was really doing well, and when it was a magnet for foreign investment. Those things made its currency very strong. It's now weakening a bit as the economy weakens. What I mean by missing a window of time is it didn't invest in infrastructure and people to the extent it could have. And finally, the price of gold. The price of gold goes up when there's high uncertainty about the future, and there certainly is uncertainty about the election and the cliff. It goes up when people worry about inflation.
My guest is Barry Eichengreen. He's professor of political science and economics at UC Berkeley and author of the book Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. Join the conversation by calling us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Barry Eichengreen. He's professor of political science and economics at Berkeley and author of Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. How severe an impediment are the ongoing problems we have in this country with federal budget deficits to the ongoing stability of the dollar as the dominant global currency?
They're not terribly severe today as we speak because of the absence of alternatives. People who are worried about our financial and budgetary future in the United States don't know quite where to go. They don't want to run to the euro. Because of Chinese regulations, they can't run to the renminbi. They've been piling into the Swiss franc, but Switzerland is a very small country and doesn't have a lot of financial assets outstanding. So I would say not a significant risk yet today, but those things can change very quickly if Europe and China get their act together and there all are alternatives. People will begin to look for alternatives to the dollar, and they'll be out there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Margaret in Keene. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question for you, I appreciate so much your intelligence. My question is, isn't it risky to deal with China, given their abominable human rights record in 1965. They just swallowed up Tibet, and they're busy trying to grab all the land they can. Isn't that really, really risky? And I will hang up so I can listen to your answer. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
We had a caller earlier, Terry, who was basically worried about the same thing. It is risky, clearly, to deal with the Chinese regime, but I think the question we have to ask ourselves is whether engagement is better than disengagement. We've been trying engagement for the last 30-plus years, ever since Nixon went to China. And I think China has been making slow progress in the direction that we Americans desire. So I don't want to be an apologist for the Chinese regime, but things are happening there.
Assuming the dollar, as you say, Barry, is not going away as an important global currency, but that there will be some challenges in the future, and say we have this sort of tripolar world in terms of choices for global currency, what are the repercussions for the U.S. economy?
It will be harder for the United States to finance its deficits. So one of the ways we've been able to do that is by selling safe and liquid U.S. Treasury bonds to foreign central banks and governments who like to hold them as a kind of insurance policy. If there are going to be other places to go, to the European Central Bank or the People's Bank of China, to get those liquid assets in the future, we will have to pay more to finance our budget deficit. I'm not sure that's entirely a bad thing, because it will ratchet up the pressure on our country to deal with its budgetary problem. And when we engage in financial excesses, when we blow a housing bubble again in the future, it won't be as easy for that housing bubble to really get out of control. We blew the last one partly by selling securities to foreign banks and governments that didn't have any place else to go for safe and liquid and internationally recognized financial assets. They will have alternatives in the future. And when we crawl out on an unstable financial limb, foreigners will be more ready to cut it off.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I had a question about China's problem with their slow growth rate. And the other secondary question is about how inflation is going to affect Social Security payments. And do you think our government is going to curtail Social Security at some point in the future in order to get the deficit under control?
Steve, when you say slow growth, are you talking about population growth rather than economic growth? Okay. Thanks for your call.
China's slow population growth, slow labor force growth rate is a legacy of the one-child policy that they've had for a quarter of a century. Once upon a time, their problem was to feed people, so they wanted to limit the number of hungry new mouths. Now those children are becoming the labor force. Two parents retire and one child replaces them. So that's part of China's problem. Part of its problem is it's a very export-oriented economy, and with the rest of the world in economic trouble at the moment, exporting is harder than it would be otherwise. Chris, remind me of the second.
I believe it was about the impact on this country of expanding Social Security obligations as the baby boomers retire.
Well, I think we actually have a considerable Social Security trust fund, so we have a while to address that problem, depending on whose projections you believe. We have a couple of decades still before we really have a serious problem in paying the Social Security payments that that people are due. The question opens up that can of worms about how we deal with the budget problem in the United States, and My view is that it's really very simple. We only have to do three things. Number one, expenditure restraint. Number two, raise more revenues. And number three, deal with healthcare costs. So Social Security wouldn't actually be on my top three list in terms of problems and solutions.
Your top three are challenging enough without Social Security.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Gary in Plano. Hey, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question regards Brazil. I haven't heard it mentioned in the conversation. It's a very dynamic country, probably the most fresh water of anyone in the world. Seems to have a fairly young workforce, and I would just be curious of the professor's perspective and comment on Brazil. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
A lot of people saw Brazil as one of the miracle economies, along with China and India, until recently, when the Brazilian growth rate slowed down a lot. So the advantage that Brazil has is that it's big and diversified. So they both have manufacturing. They make truck tires. They make commuter airplanes. They are serious exporters of manufacturers. But they're also exporters of minerals, commodities, natural gas, and the like. So they have the advantage of both. They have strong financial markets, well-regulated financial markets and banks by global standards. The problem they have is that they haven't been investing in their people. So they have a problem in terms of delivering education and skills, and that is now coming back to haunt them.
So a similar situation in some ways to what's going on with India.
Yeah, I view it in kind of the same way. Brazil is a higher income country. They have higher living standards as a result of their richness in commodities. They do better in terms of exporting manufacturers, but the story is similar.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ron on the line next in Hickory Creek. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I'm far less worried about our dealings with our trading partners and far more worried about our international strategies financially. It seems as though we've developed a economy where we borrow money and go buy finished goods someplace else. And I don't view that as a fundamentally sound economic strategy. The other issue I'd like to talk about real quickly is, and have a response from, is it seems to me we responded to our own banking crisis the same way the Japanese responded to their banking crisis 25 years ago. They haven't pulled out, and I don't see how we're planning on it when we continue to leave the discount window open to pretty much anybody who can crawl up to it.
Thanks for your call. Let's get some a response for you, Barry.
So on the second question first, I think that we have done better than the Japanese did in terms of our addressing our banking problems. So we did force-feed more capital into the banks, something that the Japanese failed to do for the longest time. Their banks remained weak and undercapitalized and didn't lend. U.S. banks are now stronger as a result of the actions taken since 2009, but I would certainly agree with the point that we in the United States have not done enough in terms of financial reform. We have not done enough to prevent the same kind of financial problems from occurring again. On the other hand, I don't think that raising interest rates now while the economy is still weak would help with our problems. It might help with some, but it would create more problems than it solved. On the first point, yes, it has been the case over time that we have exported green pieces of paper, dollars in various forms, and imported consumer electronics from China and BMWs from Germany, and that's not a healthy way to run an economy. It's good for the financial sector, and one of the problems we've had in the United States is that the financial sector has been too big and the manufacturing sector has been too small. I think that's now changing. The U.S. external deficit has come way down, actually, since the onset of the crisis, and the challenge going forward will be to keep it from going back up.
So is the greater responsibility at this point on, say, the Federal Reserve to make appropriate policy, the Treasury, or do you look to Congress to really get its act together in order to prolong the prominence of the dollar?
The medium-term fiscal challenge we have, in other words, balancing the budget over the next 8 years, that's what Mr. Romney said his goal was yesterday on Meet the Press, and that's pretty much Mr. Obama's goal as well. I think personally that the obstacle here is the polarization in the Congress, the unwillingness to compromise. One group that says the problem can be solved only through expenditure restraint, another group that says the problem can be solved only by raising more taxes. You know who I'm talking about, and an unwillingness to reach, inability to reach across the aisle and compromise. So I don't see the Fed as either the fundamental problem here or as offering a solution. Similarly, I don't think the Treasury, which is part of the executive branch, can do it by itself. These problems have to be addressed by legislation. And legislation originates in, it comes from the Congress.
Have we ever seen a currency fall from primacy and then return to that position?
No, we really haven't. So if you go back in history, before the dollar, the global currency was the pound sterling. Before that, it was the Dutch guilder because the Netherlands was a big trading power. Before that, it was the Genoese ducat. None of them have come back.
So could we assume a similar fate for the dollar if somehow we slip from number one?
I fear that if we slip from number one and there is flight from the dollar because of economic policy mistakes here, it will be very hard to reverse that.
Barry Eichengreen is professor of political science and economics at UC Berkeley, and he's author of the book Exorbitant Privilege, The Rise and Fall of the Dollar and the Future of the International Monetary System. The book is available now in paperback. Barry, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs. Also, you can download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.